Hey, folks, and welcome to the podcast this week. John Doe is our guest. Very interesting because to some people, this guy is such a huge part of history, part of their life. And then for so many other people, he kind of, people too old or too young or whatever, doesn't mean anything to them. And, you know, I can't remember another guest. I'm sure there are some, but I can't remember another guest. Can't put my finger on it. Somebody who was quite so polarly known or unknown. That's interesting. I wasn't sure how to approach him, and as I was preparing, I just decided to go for the kind of meandering chatter with trying to hit a few of his history points thrown in when it made sense, and that's kind of what we did, and I enjoyed it. I think it was really good, and I just got an email from somebody who thought I wasn't fully checked in. I don't know exactly what that... thinking about that. Anyway, I enjoyed it. Usually I don't leave the song that introduces the interview. I usually don't leave that in, but it's my favorite John Doe song, so we're gonna, as soon as I'm done with the intro, you'll hear an entire song, then the interview, and I think you'll enjoy it. Okay, I think there's some guests coming up. There's some stuff up in the air. Check WFMU.org/Michael to know the latest. And here's my interview with John Doe. All right, there's John Doe, the Golden State, from A Year in the Wilderness with Kathleen Edwards there. And he's coming, as I said earlier, he's coming to town. He's going to do 3 dates at Hill Country in Washington, D.C., in Brooklyn, in Manhattan, and then in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the Atwood Tavern. John Doe, welcome to the program. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. And a fine Saturday it is.
I love that song. It is... it's very John Doe to me, you know. It just sounds a lot like you. It's very catchy, yet there's something a little not exactly mainstream about it.
Well, I take that as a compliment. that I'm asking a little more of the audience than just to tap their toe, but they still can.
Yeah, well, it's a hard line to be there.
Not really. I mean, if you're a weirdo, then all you'd have to do is just act like you're not, and then you're somewhere in the middle, and hopefully it's not boring to the people that want you to be a complete psych fest.
So that's your secret.
Absolutely. I've just revealed it here on the radio. No, I think it's something you can't really, you can't decide. It's out of your power. You know, Paul McCartney writes catchy pop songs because that's what Paul McCartney does. And, you know, the Velvet Underground did what they did because that's all they could do. And it's just trying to find, like, who the hell are you, and try not to be something that you're not, because you'll probably fail at that. So.
Yeah, well, but you sort of mentioned, you know, trying to deny your weirdo side, and I think, and that's maybe responsible for the catchiness quotient in your music, and it seems like some people have a, maybe that's it, maybe Paul McCartney just is pushing his weirdo side down way too far.
No, I don't think there is any.
Oh boy, I do.
Some people have, no, you know, it's like the old Mojo Nixon song, you know, Elvis is everywhere except for in Michael J. Fox. But I don't know. That was unfair to Michael J. Fox probably at the time.
Yes.
It was funny.
Yeah.
I think even at the very beginning, X was trying to be, you know, we weren't trying to be obscure or obtuse. We were just trying to have fun and play something that was loud and fast and cool, you know. But we weren't trying to be the, you know, obscure.
Were you trying to, I mean, what were the expectations? Were the expectations we will become rock stars and be on the radio, you know, next to Van Halen?
Oh, hell no. We didn't really care.
Hmm.
I think my expectations were that we would be the next Velvet Underground. And it's weird that I would, you know, call them out twice in two paragraphs. But yeah, I thought, well, I could, you know, we could do as good as Patti Smith, and lo and behold, that's what we did. Except we stuck around a lot longer.
Yeah, I was looking through, you know, I mean, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. You've been making music a long time, but looking at it all on paper, it's kind of struck me how, what a hardworking guy you must be in some ways. You know, I think it's 8 solo records, all the records with X. You've worked with the Sadies, who you're on tour with, the Knitters, Jill Sobule, all kinds of people you've collaborated with, lots and lots of touring. And I kind of thought, like, that didn't surprise me from what I know about you, but it is funny how the word punk comes up over and over and over again. And I think it's a great word. You know, it's a lovely word, but I just thought it's funny. Here's this guy who is, you know, one of the oldest establishing members of the punk community, but he works so hard. You know, it's a funny comparison.
Well, I don't know that punk rock was anti-work. I mean, I just don't have to. I don't have to know what day it is. That's the nicest, that's the best thing. I don't have to work in the day. I don't have to get up and go to work. But I also, especially on tour, I don't actually have to know what day it is. I find it's a real success. It doesn't matter. So, yeah. I mean, but even the slackerest of slackers, they've got to get out there and tour, and they've got to get out there and sell their wares. And yeah, I like working. I mean, I'm really lucky in that way. I like performing. I don't mind people too much.
The whole idea of what punk means, and I remember I'm a little bit younger than you, and I remember when things started to change and when punk started to get press coverage. People treated it like, you know, Martians from another planet. You know, these people have different color hair. They must be evil, you know. And now it's in commercials. It's, you know, it's in CVS. It's everywhere. And you know, I would guess you have some mixed feelings about that. But in you know, in some way, there's something great about that, and there's also something I don't know. Disappointing.
Well, not really. I mean, it's weird what gets co-opted and what things become. You know, the hippies gave us like wheat bread. You know, you couldn't really get brown bread before the hippies, and you know, now punk rock is assimilated. You can have a mohawk and not be made fun of, and great, whatever. I mean, I'm working on a book that's going to be out in April, and it's the L.A. punk rock story. I'm doing it with a bunch of people writing chapters. I'm the narrator, and I've written a bunch of chapters as well, but. So talking about what punk rock was and what it's become, I did a bunch of research and read all the, you know, Please Kill Me and all the books that have been out. And this is going to be different because everyone gets a chapter. And it's people like Exene or Henry Rollins or Mike Watt or, you know, all these different people that were on the scene in L.A. And yeah, it's always changing. And reading Please Kill Me, you know, it was changing from 75 to 79 or 78, you know. So it never stays static. Nothing ever does.
Tell me about your childhood and when music first came into your head as something, you know, something that you, when did it touch you, move you first?
You know, I was born in the mid-50s and when I got aware of what music was, radio was pretty great. And back then, adults, for some reason, thought that folk music was appropriate for children, with all the drinking and murder and people dying and all kinds of things like that. So, like Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie and people like that were, you know, we had these little 10-inch records that had all these crazy songs about.
So your parents bought these for you?
Sure. I mean, everybody, and that was kind of what kids' music was considered. Folk music, you know, Burl Ives and like I said, Lead Belly, and who was a murderer. So, yeah. I mean, the thing that folk, that wave of folk music had tons of images and stories. So, that was a good place to start.
And then, what first time you picked up an instrument was when?
Well, I sang in choirs and stuff like that in school, public school, in Baltimore. And my dad played piano. He played kind of classical piano. And my mom sang. When she was in college, she sang opera and stuff. And she never did anything with it. But they were pretty musical, even though they had regular jobs. And so there was a piano in the house. I used to fool around on that when I was a kid. And I bought a bass guitar when I was probably 15 or 16 because I thought it would be easier. And guess what? It is.
Only four strings.
It's only four strings, and you don't have to learn how to play leads. And if you are playing a lead on a bass guitar, you should stop and not play in that band. And that was at the height of psychedelia. That was in like 67, 68. And, you know, I was an elementary school kid when the Beatles and the British Invasion happened. And so it was good. It was a good time.
I mean, tell me, what was the scene in Baltimore? I mean, what kind of gigs were there to happen?
There were none. That's why I moved to L.A.
I mean, you're playing, there must have been some cover band. I mean, there must have been something.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I played, one of the strangest situations I was in was playing the song Imagine that, you know, John Lennon did at a revolving restaurant on the top of Holiday Inn in Washington, D.C., and there were really high-priced prostitutes picking up, like, you know, junior senators and things like that. I'm thinking, imagine there's no people, or there's no countries, or, you know, all that kind of thing. And it was just so perfectly weird. I had been to New York in 75, seen Talking Heads and saw the Heartbreakers and thought, shit, this is all happening. But I couldn't stand the East Coast. I was done with that, and just loved like California, and it's a good place.
Okay, it's so warm. It's warm. So you moved to California, and I want to know, is there like a something literally in the air? You know, is there something you can feel going around that's saying something's got to change?
I think there is. I think there's a different kind of light. You know, people talk about the light in New Mexico or in the south of France or, you know, stuff like that, where, you know, a lot of painters and I think there is. There's like distance. There's openness. There's a kind of like exhaust fumes and mountains. Sometimes you can see the mountains and sometimes you can't. But the light and you can in the East Coast, you know, it's difficult to see more than like a couple of miles. And in the West, you can see 50 miles easy.
So how did you find your kindred spirits when you got to Los Angeles?
Through poetry. I met Exene at a poetry workshop, writing workshop. And I met Billy Zoom through the Recycler, which was a paper you could, you know, buy a refrigerator or find a lead singer.
Yeah, it was Craigslist on paper, basically.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
So let's talk about poetry. I mean, it seems like poetry's always been important to you. How does, I assume since you were a child, since a high school student, how do you get into poetry, and is that a ballsy choice?
Not really. I mean, I think that, you know, ever since Jim Morrison or Bob Dylan or Joni Mitchell, it was like, this is a part of the deal. And even, you know, going back into blues songs, you know, Howlin' Wolf or Robert Johnson or that kind of thing. I mean, all those great songs was poetry, but not in an academic way. I studied it at Antioch College in Baltimore, so I kind of knew what it was about, and then I actually ran a poetry reading series in Baltimore for about a year and a half with a couple of friends. And that was one thing. That was our ace in the hole that you know, writers like to talk about, because Exene is a natural poet, and I'm a little more studied, but still threw away a lot of those lessons.
Let's talk about your singing voice. It is it's very identifiable as you, sort of, as I said at the top of the show, and it's very open. It's very, to me, it just sounds like it's you're not holding back. Is that a conscious thing? Is that something you had to work your way up to or learn? Is that just what happened when you opened your mouth?
I think I had to, if anything, scale back. I had to learn how to sing quieter rather than not to sing all out all the time.
You're singing Imagine, and so the guy in the band is saying that is too much?
Well, with rock and roll, punk rock singing, it was really unbridled, and that was kind of the point of it. I loved the way Richard Hell sang, even though it was kind of off kilter. But I could hear that, and I could take some lessons from that. But because of the volume of the band, it was kind of all out, sing hard, and then doing solo stuff. Then I realized, and I love like blues singers that are, you know, full on, just shouting and stuff. But then maybe 15 years ago, I started thinking, well, maybe I could sing a little quieter and it would be interesting, and then kind of like use the dynamics a little more.
So you moved to L.A. Did you have to have real jobs?
Sure. I was not given a Mercedes and a swimming pool as soon as I arrived in Los Angeles, much to my chagrin. And everybody in New York thought that, what the hell, what do they have to be mad about? They live in Los Angeles. But, I worked in the bookstore. I actually worked at Brentano's, which was a chain back then, and it was in the Beverly Hills Hotel, which was awesome. I got to see all kinds of stars, and it was in Beverly Hills. It was kind of being in the belly of the beast. And I helped Gloria Swanson find some some diet books. She was like vegan in the 30s or 40s. And she was tiny. She was like 5'10". She weighed about 75 pounds. It was awesome.
That sounds amazing.
This is Gloria Swanson, for God's sake.
Yeah.
She was 110, but still, it was just like, holy moly, this is like a real movie star.
I lived in L.A. for a few years, and I thought it was interesting how you did see movie stars all the time, just, you know, at the farmer's market or at the supermarket or anywhere, just driving mm-hmm. around. They were just, it's Hollywood.
Everybody got to be somewhere.
It's surreal, exactly. They got to get by groceries also. So you find Billy Zoom in the recycler, and you hook up with Xene, and eventually you get DJing There's X, and the band starts playing and signed pretty quickly, I think, to Slash Records. And the expectations, you said, were to, like, you know, Patti Smith or Velvet Underground, something like that. And like you said, the press kind of latched onto you guys because you, I guess you were probably better interviews than some and popular. So tell me, though, I mean, what was the shows like? I kind of remember, you know, there was shows in that time, because I was just a kid then, but I was going to shows, and there were some people fully into the sort of punk look, and yet there were guys who looked like they were still in the 70s in disco clothes, and it was like a very... People don't remember that not everybody was like an extra in a movie about punk rock.
That is so weird, because that's just come up a couple times in this in doing this book, and it's so true. There were a lot of people that looked like complete nerds. and so what? Great.
Yeah.
I mean, even in the earlier days, because there weren't, you know, there wasn't Vivienne Westwood, and we all, I mean, some of us kind of looked down our noses at the Sex Pistols because of that. It's like, what the? You got to dress up, you know, just go to a thrift store and find some old jeans and have fun with the, you know, rather than having designer stuff. But you know, to be fair, like how did we find each other? I think everybody found each other because there was something in the air, and that's why it happened in New York and London and L.A. kind of in that order so quickly. You know, from 75 to 70, early 77.
Can you put your finger on that thing? And does it have anything to do with sort of what you talked about earlier, hippies? Is there some like line that connects it
with what went before?
Yeah, you know, connects like the...
Yeah, we all owe Journey and the Eagles and Bob Seger, all owe them a great debt, because they had so totally alienated a lot of people from what rock and roll music was supposed to be that everybody said, oh, no, you don't. You're not this up. We're going to take this back, and we're going to make it fun again. You can't put this in big stadiums only. So, that's what I think happened.
So after two records, you guys moved to Elektra, which is, you know, part of Warner Brothers, giant label. Did they say...
No. We thought Elektra would take care of us, because the Stooges and the MC5 and the Doors... and Love, they were all on Elektra. And this guy, Joe Smith, who signed us, just sort of, I don't know why he did it, because he thought, well, I know why he did it, because we sold out the Greek Theater, which is 7,000 people, and we had two records on some dumb label called Slash, you know, an indie label that had terrible distribution. But we sold out an outdoor 7,000-seat place. They're finally thinking, well, okay, we can't be this stupid and just, you know, keep our heads buried in the ground and think that classic rock is all that there is.
And do you think they understood where you guys were coming from or what you wanted to do? Did they care?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we didn't. So why would they? We didn't know what we were doing. We just were doing what we did.
You were just, you know, going. So they didn't sit you in a room and say, kid, we're going to make a video and you know, and we're going to get you a real producer and we're going to make hit records? Was there any of that?
No, because we had Ray Manzarek. And Ray was, you know, rock royalty. I think it was a little bit, you know, I talked to a guy who was part of Geffen when Nirvana blew up. And I said, did you guys have any idea what was going on? And they said, nope. We just said, let's keep pressing records and step out of the way.
Yeah.
And to their credit, that's what they did.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't really get much A&Ring because they didn't understand it, and we were just doing our thing.
Yeah. Let me remind everybody, John Doe is our guest, and as I said earlier, he's coming to town with the Sadies to the Hill Country Barbecue restaurant / venue, the one in Brooklyn and the one in Manhattan next weekend, the 23rd and 24th, but also to the Hill Country in D.C. and also to Atwood's Tavern in Cambridge, and you can check the, T-H-E-E, johndoe.com for information and links to all that stuff. And I'm sure those are going to be great shows because there's always something going on with you and there's always something good with all of your work. Tell me about now you're on the road with X. Tell me about good and bad double bills. Tell me like great bands you got to see during that time or terrible double bill bands.
Oh my. Well, all the great bands were people that were our contemporaries and a bunch of people like Jane's Addiction and Chili Peppers and Go-Go's and all those people, you know, opened for us and that was great. Terrible double bills. We had a pretty difficult tour with Warren Zevon because his fans didn't like us and our fans didn't like him and we didn't particularly like each other. I don't know why we did it. But that was in like 87, I think. Billy Zoom had already left the band, and Tony Gilkison was soldiering on, and that was kind of hard. But we got to play with some really cool people. You know, and we got to do some TV shows with Chuck Berry and the Temptations, and it was called and James Brown, and we played the first Farm Aid and all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah.
But can I just say that when you announced all those gigs and everything, that was so professional. Can I just say that I am like, I give you some props, as the kids like to say, because that was really like hip and just boom, there you go.
Well, you're welcome. I do want to, you know, remind everybody what's going on. It's part of all I'm here to help direct people's
sure.
weekend night activities.
By the way, I have an FMU shirt that I wear quite a bit. The one that has the dog and the cow.
Yeah, Woof Moo.
Woof Moo. Yeah. Yeah.
I wear the one, that same one. Thank you.
I wear it proudly.
It's a groovy shirt. Talk about songwriting. As I said in the beginning, you're so prolific. You are such a you know, does it take a long time? Is it like lightning striking? Is it hard work? How does it happen?
More lightning. I wait for more inspiration, but I'll have a store of pieces of writing, and then when I just figure, okay, it's time to write a new record, I'll have some other pieces of music, and I'll match them up. Similar to the way that I did with X. But nowadays, I'm not all that prolific. You know, I put a record out every 3 to 4 years. I have a new one coming out in April, if I can just figure out who's going to put it out and how. But it'll definitely be on vinyl.
So you're a notebook guy. You're jotting it.
Yeah, but I don't have... I don't do, like, subjects. You know, I'm going to write a song on... the trees. Trees. What do the trees mean to, you know, something like that. It's more like just a musical phrase, an idea, some kind of like the pattern of words, and then it'll start a subject, and then it'll be about something, and I don't necessarily know what it is. So it has a rhythm and a pattern, and it's about something, sort of. And then I do a lot of editing afterward. I'll wait until it's inspiring again.
Is sort of having a background in poetry, are you harder on yourself? You know, does each word become...
No, I don't. I'm not constipated in writing. I just sort of do it as it happens, and it's all. I just kind of. I've learned how to let it flow, and. This is so scatological. Anyway,
you're not constipated, but you've learned how to let it flow. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, God. So embarrassing. So early in the morning. So embarrassing. Anyway, no, because I do know some people that write, and they're so precious, and they're like prying every word out of their mouth, and it's just kind of just let it go, and then figure it out later. What I find lately, within the last 10, 15 years, is the little words, if you change little things here and there, it can make a big difference. Like just articles, like in or on or, you know, stuff like that.
Are there songs that you wrote, you know, 40 years ago that you sing now with X that you don't relate to anymore?
Not in the way that I did then, but, you know, they were universal enough. We didn't say, you know, Ronald Reagan sucks too much. Maxine was very, very crafty about the political songs that she wrote most of those. The New World and I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts. And, you know, when you're talking about, we were talking about El Salvador, but it relates to the Middle East just as easily. So,
talk about, I think you're a parent, is that right?
Oh, yeah, I have three daughters. They're grown and beautiful.
I'm curious. How was that experience for you? Were you a good parent?
I think so. Yeah, I'm still in touch with them. I live close by them, and we see each other all the time. So I must have done something right. They didn't, you know, say screw you and move to the other side of the country. that's a whole like 2-hour, 2-day interview, but. It's not the only thing, and I kind of resent it when people say, oh, my God, my kids, blah, 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 and they go on and on and on. And it's like, I love my kids. They're incredible, and having boundaries is a good thing. So you don't just give up your entire life for your children. It's one really positive element of one's life.
Yeah.
Can be.
I was looking, you know, I've seen you.
Not to mention, I'm incredibly fortunate that they're healthy and they're not in jail and they're not drug addicts, and all those things are possible as well.
I've seen you acting over the years, but I didn't realize how much until, again, I looked at it on paper. You've been in so many television shows and movies. I mean, like 100, you know, like an actor, you know, like so many.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you don't do stuff you don't enjoy, so I'm assuming you enjoy doing that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's another kind of creative thing. I take it really seriously when I get a job, but you have to get someone to give you a job. And I'm pretty mercenary about it, actually. It's like, okay, how much time and how much money? But I've been really fortunate to make a couple of good friends like Allison Anders and you know, had a chance to work in some pretty high-end things like Roadhouse. The most expensive B-movie ever made, and I stand by that.
Yeah. People love that movie, to watch it in cable late at night. And
People have you know, like Roadhouse parties, yeah. and they have Roadhouse-themed showings of it where people show up as the, you know, crappy bouncer and the you know, airheaded busty babe. You know, it's so insane. It's cultish now.
Yes, it's the Rocky Horror Picture Show of the 80s. Yeah, it's,
yeah.
I don't know.
Weird.
So do you go auditions? Are you that kind of an actor?
I have. Yeah, I have and do. You know, nowadays you just do it on your phone. It's so strange.
Oh.
You do it in your house, and your, you know, friend or sweetheart holds the phone, and you do some acting against a white wall, and it's very bizarre, and then you load it on and send it in to your agent, and then they send it, and usually you hear nothing.
You just finished a tour with X, a pretty long tour. You're touring with X in December, starting with a couple nights at the Roxy right there on beautiful Sunset Boulevard. I know Billy Zoom is not well. He's sick, and part of, I think, the message of these shows is to kind of get some support going for him. You know, X is, there's four interesting people in that band. I know Billy was out of the band for a while, but, you know, you know these guys for 40 years, you know, and I know that when you're on tour, you're like, 3 feet from them on stage and 3 feet from them in a van and 3 feet from them in the coffee shop. And you know each other's jokes by now. And, you know, you have a long relationship with Exene. So what's it like, you know, to know these guys for 40 years? What's it like to be with them now and to know that?
Oh, God.
Another 2 hours we need?
That's a book. And I'll have to write that one next. It's a family, you know, for better or for worse. I don't know what your family's like, but families are complicated. But at the same time, you love them, and you can't imagine what it would be like without them, even though you may want to kill them at times. So, Billy has got a great prognosis with bladder cancer. He's in, like on a maintenance kind of thing, and Jesse Dayton, who I played with in my solo band, has stepped in, and he filled in for Billy when he couldn't tour in December. It might be both of them. I don't even know, because Billy's just getting over the first round of treatment. So, yeah, I'm connected to Exene in a way that is unlike a lot of relationships, and she is an amazing partner, and so it's a great thing, and I think we're all finally realizing after 40 years, because it'll be 40 years in 2017.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It'll be 40 years that the band has been around. Yeah, I know. It's frightening. But, you realize that it's got legs. It's got legacy. It's got longevity and a bunch of other L words.
You know, you think about, like, you know, I don't know, something like Sgt. Pepper that people are always having anniversaries or birthdays for. And, you know, it's only whatever. It's less than 10 years older than X, you know. Somehow that seems like a whole different, you know, there's no relevance. It's only nostalgia that we look at Sgt. Pepper, whereas X is somehow, even though it's really almost the same age as Sgt. Pepper, it seems so much more contemporary. I don't know.
It's a strange thing. I mean, if you think about the New York scene and the LA scene, the core of it only lasted about 2 years. It's so bizarre because it so much happened in such a short period of time. And the same goes, I mean, the same goes from, like, the beginning of the beatniks in, you know, the late 40s to the, like, integration movement and Vietnam and psychedelic bands and boom, 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 boom. And it was all pretty quick. Yeah.
As I said in the beginning of the show, you seem to be a busy guy. But what do you do? What do you do when you don't have work? And you make your own breakfast. You told me you just finished making your breakfast. What do you do all day?
I do normal stuff, and then I do some dreaming, and I have a couple horses that I have at a crappy stables, and my daughter and I go out and ride them, and I love being around them because they make you slow down, and I hang out with my sweetheart and make food and screw around.
It sounds good.
Yeah, I'll never be rich, but I have a good time.
John Doe is our guest, the John Doe, T-H-E-E, johndoe.com, for information about those gigs at Hill Country and up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And like I said, X touring in December, really almost the entire month of December, mostly on the West Coast there. Tell me about the Sadies quickly, because I love that you made a record with them. We're going to hear It Just Dawned on Me. They're guys from Canada, the land of Michael J. Fox. Tell me how you hooked up. How'd you hook up with them?
We're both on Yep Rock Records, and we did a festival in Toronto about 2007 or 8. And I was a big fan of theirs, records and stuff they'd done with Nico Case. And I said, what if you played on a few songs, which they learned, and we did. And then we got, you know, drunk and said, let's make a record together. And instead of just forgetting about it, we actually did it. And I thought about making a country western type record for a long time, but it always seemed kind of boring. I mean, you talked about, you know, what my voice is like, and I don't have a really, I may have be able to sing, but I don't have a really unique sounding voice like, you know, Billie Holiday or Bob Dylan or something like that. So to put my voice with a standard country western band, it would just be dull, I thought. But the Sadies are anything but standard. They're crazy, and but they play a style of they have really broad influences. They play a style of country music that's really unique. So that's why we made the record, and we took all the best songs we could think of and that we could get away with, and put them on a record, like Waylon Jennings songs and Tammy Wynette and Hank Williams and whatever we could get away with.
Johnny Cash, yeah. But then there's this one song, It Just Dawned on Me, which you wrote with Exene. Do you remember writing the song or what the genesis of the song was?
Yeah, Exene had a really horrible husband. and she kind of just told me, you know, was talking about how she wished he'd just go away. And then I wrote the song. And eventually he did, thank God.
It is amazing that sometimes it does just, you know, a light bulb goes off and you think, yeah, I'm in a relationship I shouldn't be in. You know, what's inside us that makes us stay in those situations? I don't know.
Oh, you know, self-loathing and low self-esteem. I don't know either.
Well, I've really enjoyed our chat this morning.
The good thing about the John Doe and Sadies show is that the Sadies get to do some of their songs. I do a few solo songs. We do a couple X songs. And then we do all this other country western stuff, which is like comfort food. And it's really, they're such an incredible band. I mean, they backed up all kinds of other artists, like, you know, John Langford or Andre Williams, and they just have so much musicality and without being too precious about it. They just let it rip, and it's so much fun.
Well, John Doe, thanks so much. Let's hear It Just Dawned on Me, because, again, just a terrific song, and you can go see... do you do this one live?
Oh, yes.
So maybe you can see this one Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday next week. Check out thejohndoe.com for information. Thanks.
Sure, Michael. That was long and pretty fun.
You were always there for the last 7 years, sleeping in our bed, resting your penny little head. Started sleeping lighter and lighter every night. You were already up making coffee by the dawn's early light. Well, I was happy dreaming in a happy home. And I woke up, I was alone. Just dawned on me, you're gone, you're gone. An old flame caught your eye and whispered, away from here. Your mama and your daddy slept in a soft feather bed. I hope you wind up in the jailhouse with a cement floor for your head. 'Cause I'll be happy dreaming in a happy home. I'll wake up, just dawned on me, you're gone.
glad you're gone.